in a day was being killed. And talk about settlers and the army.
Yeah, I think part of the concern, and I know Raji was addressing that when he talked about root causes, is that some of the root causes of the violence, including what Human Rights Watch and many other groups have called apartheid, are invisible to U.S. policymakers. We have a situation where U.S. policymakers are very busy brokering normalization deals between the most right-wing Israeli government in history and dictatorial Arab governments, and it's not paying attention to what's happening on the ground. For decades, the Israeli authorities have engaged in systemic repression of Palestinians, including not allowing people in Gaza, refugees in Gaza, to return to their homes in what is now Israel, and including a punishing closure for the last 16 years that has not allowed appropriate supplies to enter and leave Gaza and has not allowed people to travel. And that's part of the reason why people in Gaza were so vulnerable.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, and we're in our annual fall membership drive. You can help us meet our $55,000 goal by going to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution today. All donations will be matched up to $14,000 thanks to a generous group of anonymous donors. KBOO's independent programming is only possible with your support. Give now at kboo.fm/give.
This is KBOO Portland, and that was Democracy Now! Special thanks to some of our recent donors to our fall membership drive. Our thanks to Preston B., Ron M., Rose E., William F., and Douglas C. Be like these fabulous people and support KBOO with a donation. kboo.fm/give. Now it's time for your KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, Multnomah County will provide more district attorneys, investigators, and officers to TriMet Public Transit.
Republican Representative Jim Jordan loses his first floor vote to become House Speaker.
And we take a look at tips to help avoid holiday scams before they happen.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 17th, 2023. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Paul Kim.
And I'm Ken Jones. The Multnomah County District Attorney's Office will now provide an extra deputy district attorney to prosecute crimes on TriMet buses and trains. That increases the total number of deputy DAs to two. District Attorney Mike Schmidt announced the addition of two more investigators to TriMet in a press conference today.
Our office has had a prosecutor that works on TriMet cases since 1998. But today what we're talking about is the enhancement of that relationship and the intergovernmental agreement that we've signed with TriMet, enhancing our prosecutorial resources. We're also handling or increasing investigator resources on public transportation so that we can work seamlessly with the sheriff and her team. You know, for us, this is a priority for our office, and we're excited to see this relationship grow. We know that this means that we'll be able to hold more people accountable and make our public transportation system even more secure.
That was Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt. The county sheriff, Nicole Morrissey O'Donnell, has also committed two more deputies to TriMet's police force. There are 65 budgeted positions for transit cops, but only 18 are filled at TriMet. Here's what Sheriff Morrissey O'Donnell said of the partnership.
As the sheriff of Multnomah County, I value TriMet's support of each of our respective offices. As you will hear and have heard today, these new resources will provide a number of benefits. For the officers and deputies assigned to TriMet and Transit Police Division, these resources will help streamline investigations, while also freeing up our transit police officers to be more visible on our transit system and around our transit locations, interrupting criminal activity, as well as preventing additional crime. More specifically, the DA investigators will bridge the gap between our police officers and deputy district attorney by working directly with the officers, reviewing referrals, and providing the necessary follow-up to strengthen these cases. Some of the follow-up that they will be doing will include reviewing video and reports and assisting officers in identifying and locating individuals who have been engaged in criminal activity. All of this work is very time-consuming, and this collaboration empowers our deputies and officers to become more proficient in building cases while also ensuring that when police reports result in a criminal charge, that they can be pursued by the district attorney's office. As the district attorney's office is introducing new resources through this amended agreement with TriMet, I am also announcing that I am increasing deputy sheriffs and supervisors to the Transit Police Division.
That was Multnomah County Sheriff Nicole Morrissey O'Donnell. The $2 million agreement between TriMet and Multnomah County lasts through June of 2025.
U.S. Republican Representative Jim Jordan was rejected in his first vote to become Speaker of the House. 20 holdout Republicans denied Jordan the seat after he won the Republican nomination by secret ballot yesterday. Jordan is known as a hardline Trump ally, and those who rejected him see him as too extreme for the powerful speakership. He was one of several Republicans who denounced the House investigation into the January 6th insurrection as a, quote, partisan witch hunt. One of those holdouts was Oregon's 5th District Republican, Congresswoman Lori Chavez de Remire. She said in a statement, quote, "It's clear that the Republican conference is still divided, and I'm deeply concerned that the chaos of the last few weeks would only continue if Congressman Jordan becomes Speaker," end quote. It's been 2 weeks of infighting since extreme right-wing Republicans voted Speaker Kevin McCarthy out of office. Jordan needs 217 votes to become the Speaker of the House. Until someone becomes Speaker, House business is at a standstill. The next vote is expected on Wednesday.
Muslim Americans blame anti-Palestinian rhetoric for a child's fatal stabbing. Representative Jim Jordan claimed progress ahead of his House Speaker vote, and Tennessee Republicans could reject federal education funds. With more on the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
We consider ourselves to be a real part of the American society. We are here to build, we are helping, we are doing the best of what we can.
Yusuf Hanan asks for peace following the killing of his 6-year-old Muslim nephew. Authorities say the boy and his mother were stabbed by their landlord after the man became obsessed with war coverage. Jewish and Muslim groups both report a rise in threats. President Joe Biden has voiced support for Israel, but the White House is also trying to open an aid corridor into Gaza. Humanitarian groups describe crowded hospitals close to losing power and hundreds of thousands of refugees in a desperate search for bread and water. Republicans in the House plan a floor vote for Speaker today. Politico describes a high-pressure campaign, including primary threats by frontrunner Jim Jordan of Ohio, that has converted at least 2 holdouts. Texas Representative Dan Crenshaw supports Jordan, but tells CNN democracy is messy.
I think what the real problem is that we've allowed a different process of democracy to take hold within our own conference, which is that majority doesn't rule.
The D.C. federal judge presiding over former President Donald Trump's 2020 election interference trial is barring Trump from making public statements targeting prosecutors or court staff. It's the second gag order imposed on him in a month. Trump is suing former British spy Christopher Steele over a dossier tying Trump to Russian 2016 election interference. Trump claims the shocking and scandalous charges damaged his reputation, but Steele's lawyers are asking the UK court to toss the suit. Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey says 23,000 newly arrived migrants, half of them children, have pushed emergency shelters to capacity. Healey says she's no longer waiting for the federal government to speed up work permits.
They want to work. They want to support their families. And we have thousands of open jobs going unfilled here in our state.
Some Republican lawmakers in Tennessee say the state should reject all federal education funding. The state gets nearly $2 billion a year, most of it for low-income students and students with disabilities. House Speaker Cameron Sexton says parents and the state would have more freedom without it.
When you take federal government money, their philosophies, what they want you to do is different than probably what the state wants to do.
In Ohio, voting is underway for a November ballot measure to enshrine abortion rights in the state's constitution. Polls show nearly 60% of Ohio voters say abortion should be legal, but Republican Governor Mike DeWine is voting no.
It would make us have some of the most pro-abortion laws in the nation. It would put us in the same category as California and other states. That's just not where Ohio is.
I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The wildflower Nelson's Checker Mallow was put on the endangered species list 30 years ago. Now, it no longer needs the protection. It's native to Oregon and southwest Washington and grows on prairies, wetlands, and on the edges of woodlands and riparian areas in the Willamette Valley and Coast Range. It grows 15 to 40 inch tall spikes of deep pink flowers. It was threatened in the early 90s by agricultural development, stream alterations, and roadside spraying. But now the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is preparing to delist the plant in the next 30 days. There are 38 independent populations in more than 50 locations from Corvallis to Vancouver, Washington.
Gun deaths among children and teens have spiked dramatically between 2011 and 2021, according to new research published in the journal Pediatrics. Nadia Ramlagan has more in Kentucky.
Gun deaths among children nationwide have increased by 87% over the past decade, while injuries and deaths from car accidents have decreased by nearly half, according to a new study. The data show more than 2,500 kids and teenagers died of firearm injuries in 2021. Pediatrician at Children's National Hospital, Dr. Annie Andrews, says while many households own guns for recreation or protection against intruders, guns in the home have consistently been linked to increased risk for homicides and suicides.
Those of us who do this work, those of us who work in children's hospitals, are not at all surprised to see these numbers. And the most frustrating thing about this as a pediatrician is that these deaths and injuries are preventable.
In Kentucky, 91% of homicide deaths in 2020 occurred in children between ages 1 and 17, and around 66% of those cases involved firearms, according to Kentucky Youth Advocates. Andrews says gun violence is worsening in the midst of a mental health crisis, especially among youths. She notes impulsive behavior among teens combined with high rates of depression and anxiety, and easy access to firearms have driven fatality rates for firearm suicide among young people up by 85%.
If they have a bad day and if they have a passing impulse to harm themselves, and in that moment of the passing impulse, they also have access to an unsecured firearm, that impulse can turn lethal in a matter of seconds.
Parents can find more information on how to prevent unintentional shootings through the Be Smart for Kids Secure Storage campaign, which encourages families to normalize conversations about gun safety and take actions that can prevent gun injuries, deaths, and youth suicide. This is Nadia Ramlagan for Kentucky News Connection.
With holiday shopping season on the near horizon, security experts are offering tips for avoiding efforts by scammers to separate people from their hard-earned money. Eric Gladys has more.
As the winter holiday season approaches, consumer advocates and federal agencies are warning the public to be on the lookout for telltale signs of a scam. Mark Federhoff with AARP ElderWatch Colorado says because people are expecting packages at this time of year, scammers have found great success separating people from their hard-earned money by posing as delivery officials.
Text messages reporting to be from the Postal Service or FedEx or UPS, notification that something's either wrong with the package or you need to click on a link to get more information about the package.
One way to ensure delivery is to send tracking information and expected arrival dates to recipients, even if it might spoil the surprise. If you are contacted, Federhoff says do not click links in texts or email. Call the company where you place the order and ask if there are any problems. To help keep others from falling victim, Federhoff encourages people to report incidents by calling the ElderWatch helpline at 800-222-4444. In the first half of 2023, more than 1 million Americans lost $4.4 billion to scammers, according to Federal Trade Commission data. Commission attorney Sophia Siddiqui said in a news briefing to Ethnic Media Services that scammers want you to pay using methods similar to cash, which are hard to trace and make it nearly impossible to get your money back.
Nobody legitimate will demand that you have to pay with gift cards, cryptocurrency, or a wire transfer. And if someone you don't know asks you to pay with one of these methods, it's likely a scam.
Social media has become the go-to platform for scammers to reach consumers, which resulted in spoils of $658 million during the first 6 months of this year. Scams via telephone saw the largest median per-person loss at $1,400. Bank transfers accounted for $901 million lost, by far the largest cash pipeline for scammers. This is Eric Galatis for the Colorado News Connection.
You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $55,000 by the end of October. You can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with the organizers of the Portland Fermentation Festival. At 6, it's Transpositive PDX, then at 7, For the Wild. Tonight's weather, mostly clear with a few clouds and an overnight low of 50 degrees. Tomorrow's weather, sunny with a high of 71. Today in history, in 1905, Mexican-American broadcaster and activist Raul A. Cortez was born. He founded the first full-time Spanish-language radio station in the U.S. in 1946 at KCOR in San Antonio. The quote of the day is from columnist Peggy Noonan, who said, quote, TV gives everyone an image, but radio gives birth to a million images in a million brains.
The Elders and Youth Conference celebrates 40 years in Anchorage, Alaska. People from all over the state come to take part in the four-day event. With that story and more, it's Jill Freitas with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas from KMBA in Anchorage, Alaska, filling in for Antonia Gonzalez. The 40th annual statewide Elders and Youth Conference kicked off Sunday at the Dena'ina Center in downtown Anchorage. People from all over Alaska came to town to take part in the four-day event, as well as the Alaska Federation of Natives convention that will take place later this week. This is the third time Joseph Johnson Sr. from Angoon has taken part in the conferences and said it is very important for elders and youth to come together.
Get all the young kids and everyone together as a group and then split them up and where they can talk and tell other people what's going on in their community, what makes it really interesting.
Ann Stepton from Juneau escorted five elders to Anchorage. She said the children can be a healing source for the elders.
Mostly for me, it is bringing elders into a space where they can find some healing, because a lot of our elders have faced a lot of traumas in their life. We have a lot of generational trauma, and I am a huge believer in connecting our youth with our elders, and the youth bring a lot of healing to our elders.
Those who attended Monday and Tuesday heard keynote speeches from Elder Dolores Churchill, the last remaining Haida birth speaker in the state, an indigenous land protector and model Quanah chasing horse. The USDA is awarding $500,000 in contracts to four tribal buffalo producers located within South Dakota. The move is part of what the agency hopes will offer more ground bison meat for tribal communities. SDPB's Lee Strubinger has more.
Officials with the USDA say they want to change how the agency purchases and delivers bison to local communities. The agency is announcing a pilot program they say will offer more ground bison to communities through the Food Distribution Program on Indian Reservations. It seeks to align purchasing timeframes with how ranchers manage bison herds. Heather Don Thompson is the USDA Director of Tribal Relations and an enrolled member of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. She says the program will benefit local producers who want to sell meat to the federal government.
It's very challenging to be able to sell to the federal government as a small producer. And South Dakota has lots of small and family producers. And this provides an opportunity for those producers to really participate in the federal procurement process.
Thompson says the program will benefit communities near bison herds that receive provisions from federal food initiatives. The USDA awarded contracts to four tribally owned herds and managers in the Cheyenne River, Rosebud, Lower Brule, and Standing Rock reservations. Jenny Moffitt is an undersecretary with the USDA who oversees purchasing. She says bison present a unique challenge when it comes to federal food distribution.
There are certain times of the year when bison are harvested, and if we're buying year-round and we're expecting and asking for full truckloads worth of bison, and that's just not something that the producers can meet, they're not able to participate in these programs, and that is just such a miss.
The USDA says it will align purchase timeframes with infrequent animal handling, traditional field harvests, and a nature-based calendar. The agency says it will take lessons learned from the pilot to take the program further in the future. For National Native News, I'm Lee Strubinger.
I'm Jill Freitas.
Wednesday is Bioenergy Day, a day to promote energy derived from natural sources such as scrap wood. Some have identified bioenergy as a potential energy fix in the face of climate change. Suzanne Potter explains.
Tomorrow is National Bioenergy Day, which raises awareness about local renewable wood energy markets that convert waste wood into energy. 66 million dead trees are piling up in California forests, making the state vulnerable to destructive megafires, such as the one that wiped out the town of Paradise in 2018. Helena Murray with the U.S. Forest Service says the agency is teaming up with the state of California to treat 1 million acres of forest each year.
Fire prevention work can include removing some trees to make more space so that there's less likelihood of severe fires happening, and fuels reduction so that we can restore our forest to a more resilient ecosystem.
Biomass plants use waste wood from the forests and scrap wood from construction to create steam that turns a turbine to create electricity. The process does release some carbon dioxide, but Murray says it cuts down on criteria pollutants by 95% compared to open burning. The resulting ash is used as bedding in livestock pens to reduce mud. Julie Malinowski-Ball with the California Biomass Energy Alliance says bioenergy can help California meet its renewable energy goals.
You have all this waste that you need to do something with, and you might as well create a co-benefit to disposing of it. So you take wood waste that is piling up, send it to a bioenergy facility, generate a renewable electricity as opposed to putting it in a landfill.
Other forms of bioenergy include gas harvested from municipal solid waste and from dairy farms. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
It's been 10 days since Hamas's first attack on Israel and the beginning of Israel's bombardment of Gaza. Now we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertoff. The opinions expressed in this following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. The following item appeared in the Washington Post. Quote, all signs indicate that the government of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is prepared to wage a protracted battle in the battered Gaza Strip as it seeks to crush the capabilities of the Islamic militant group Hamas. The ongoing conflict has already exacted a heavy toll. A Hamas spokesman said Netanyahu's threats did not frighten Hamas or the Palestinian people. Unquote. Actually, this article is not about recent events. It's from July 2014, the last time Israeli troops invaded Gaza, which should have made the surprise attack by Hamas fighters less of a surprise. In fact, this explosion was sure to come for at least two reasons: the terrible conditions in Gaza during 16 years of Israeli blockade, and the coming to power of Israeli's far right. Dire economic and social conditions in Gaza have been reported for many years. The exceptional density of the population, the squalid state of housing, the uncertainty of access to food, fuel, and health care. These conditions set the stage for Hamas the dominant political force in Gaza, with lines of communication and military assistance to Tehran to exploit at a time of its choosing. The other factor behind the Hamas attacks seems to be less considered, the link between the far-right Netanyahu administration's efforts to weaken judicial independence and the increased threat to Palestinian livelihoods. Netanyahu, power-hungry and oblivious to human rights and ethical principles, appointed people to his cabinet who are committed to remaking Israel into a Jewish state. They support removing Palestinians from Israel entirely, expanding settlements into occupied territory, and denying citizenship to non-Jews. For Palestinians, if the far-right's agenda on the judiciary gains approval, they will face a dramatic erosion of the most ordinary rights, starting with their property. The legitimate grievances of the Palestinian people do not, however, excuse or lessen the brutality and inhumanity of the Hamas fighters who descended on the kibbutzim and music festival. Their wanton killings of innocent men, women, and children cannot be called justifiable resistance or hailed as turning the tables on Israel's colonial rule. Hamas has committed murder and will pay the price, to the great misfortune of the Gazans in whose name Hamas is supposedly acting. Already, the UN estimates that 340,000 Palestinians have been displaced by Israeli attacks, 1,300 have died, public facilities such as hospitals are without power. And on Friday, Israel warned over 1 million Gazans that they should leave their homes, probably in anticipation of an invasion, a prospect that the UN said would have devastating humanitarian consequences. Israel shares the responsibility for the unfolding tragedy in Gaza. Consider what Yoav Gallant, Israel's defense minister, said the other day. We will wipe this thing called Hamas, ISIS, Gaza off the face of the earth. It will cease to exist, unquote. That's not a strategy. It's vengeance. It's a promise of mass retribution. That perspective frames the war for most Palestinians, including those who are committed to nonviolence, such as Mustafa Barghouti of the Palestinian National Initiative. He told the PBS NewsHour on October 11 that, quote, what we see today is a very intensive campaign to dehumanize not Hamas alone, but to dehumanize Palestinians completely. And the war that Israel is conducting today is not at Hamas, it is at the Palestinian people in Gaza, unquote. Leaders in war often see it as an opportunity rather than a burden. Such, I believe, is the case with Netanyahu. Before the Hamas attacks, he was in deep political trouble, unable to find a way out of the controversy over the judiciary. Hamas has given him a way out, at least for now. Netanyahu is using the rally round the flag effect not just to sideline the protesters, but also to bring a few of the opponents into a so-called unity government. He has co-opted the opposition, in short. Everyone now must support Netanyahu's announced war purpose of destroying Hamas and leveling Gaza. Unfortunately, that seems to include the United States, which, far from pressing Israel for restraint, is essentially giving it a blank check, one that could lead to a wider war and more direct U.S. involvement. Consider what Secretary of State Antony Blinken said at a news conference recently. Quote, Israel has both the right and even the obligation to defend its people. But at the same time, the way Israel does it does matter. Quote, Blinken had an opportunity to demand accountability and lawfulness from Israeli officials, but instead chose polite words that will ensure more killing. Consequently, prospects for stopping the fighting soon are extremely limited. A ceasefire or other temporary agreement probably will come only after terrible losses of life and property. Losses that, if past Israeli-Palestinian conflicts are any guide, will be far greater on the Palestinian side than on the Israeli side. It has been said before, but bears repeating, Israelis will never be secure until Palestinians are secure. I'm Mel Gartoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 17th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gortov and David Rosenberg. The producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Shantia Hudson, Jill Freitas, Catherine Carley, Suzanne Potter, and Eric Galatis. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Paul Kim.
And I'm Ken Jones. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, so now's a great time to join. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO's News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The annual Portland Fermentation Festival, affectionately known as Stinkfest, is back this year after a three-year hiatus due to the pandemic. The festival returns for the 11th time since it started in 2009, this Thursday, October 19th from 6 to 9 p.m. at EcoTrust Irving Street Studio and Rooftop Terrace in Portland's Pearl District. We hosted the festival organizers Liz Crane, Heidi Nessler, and Claudia Lucero, collectively known as the Stinkfest Queens, for a preview of the 10th annual event in 2019. And we're fortunate to have two of the queens here with us today, Liz and Heidi. Thanks so much for coming into KBOO, bearing samples of some of the treats you'll be featuring at the festival. And Claudia, if you're listening, we miss you.
Oh, thanks for having us on, Ken.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, Liz, let's start with you. You were one of the organizers of the very first